You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions. Welcome to the Rock Art Podcast. This is episode 158, and I'm going to be your co-host today, Chris Webster. Today, I talk with Alan about obsidian conveyance systems in the Pacific Northwest and what that means. To the Rock Art Podcast, this is Chris Webster, and I'll be co-hosting today with Dr. Alan Garfinkel. And if you're hearing my voice, that means we don't have a guest, and we are going to have a conversation about something incredibly interesting. Alan, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Chris. Yeah, this is a little bit unusual for a Rock Art podcast, but you've been asking me about this and it seems others are interested as well. And what we're going to talk about today is something that is near and dear to my heart. It's called obsidian conveyance systems. Now, that sounds rather esoteric, but what it really relies on is the ability of volcanic glass, obsidian, which was one of the top tippy, most valuable commodities for native people because it was sharper than hell and worked out as a pretty decent projectile, was acquired. How it was acquired, when it was acquired, at what distance was it acquired, and how did that work in terms of things that are more generally important when you're reconstructing prehistoric lifeways, like connections? How did they get it? Was it trade? Was it exchange? Was it social ties? Also, what else? Just the implications of understanding exchange systems and trading systems is something that is looked upon in the far West, I would say, as something of great importance. And we have had in the past one of the top people on a podcast who has really moved the game up much higher in precision. And that was Sandy Rogers, who's a really a pioneer, or the sort of the, you know, the most prestigious, the top tier person who has been working on dating obsidian and also recognizing the nature of that volcanic glass source and what the best way is to place it in time. So all this is integrated in our conversation today. How's that?
Yeah. And sourcing is something I feel like we've talked about on probably this show, it's been mentioned, but I used to do the Archaeotech podcast, and we definitely talked about obsidian sourcing there. But just for the audience that may not be aware, and you can elaborate on this, but obsidian has like a chemical fingerprint from the volcano with which it was created. And if you can look at an obsidian piece, you can get the exact chemical makeup of this piece of obsidian. And if the source has been found, now there is obsidian out there where we actually don't have any idea where it came from. We have this fingerprint, but no hand to put it on, right? So we know the fingerprint, but we just haven't found the source yet. And that's one of the big things in archaeology, especially here in the West, where there's a lot of obsidian quarries and obsidian sources, that to find the sources for some of these things. I would probably say a lot that haven't been sourced. We've covered a lot of ground as far as that goes, but there's still some out there I know that just simply haven't been sourced. But if you have a piece, you can generally tell where it came from if you do the analysis.
And yes, and that's been one of the big efforts for the obsidian analysts, is to locate geographically and precisely the obsidian sources in the far West, both in California and up in Oregon, because there are so many quarries and they are so distinctive. And thanks to the efforts of some, you know, tremendous research, they have been able to nail down most of those particular volcanic eruptions as to when those occurred and how old the obsidian might be and its chemical fingerprint, which is rather exciting. So if we have a piece of stone, volcanic glass, it tells us a lot. It can tell us, first of all, the geographical source of that stone. Yeah. But it also can give us an inkling, a rather good one sometimes, as to the exact time span, the date that particular artifact was fashioned. That's rather an amazing set of information. So if you put that together with hundreds or thousands of such artifacts and measurements, you can create a picture of the nature of relationships, exchange, trait, and even long-distance movements of the individuals, the people that lived hundreds and thousands of years ago.
Right. Yeah, because obsidian was such a sought-after resource once people knew about it because of what it can do, and it's just the sharpness of it and things like that, that they would trade for it, you know, go far and wide to try to find it if they didn't have it near them, right? So understanding, yeah, and I would probably guess that obsidian for some groups probably generated trade networks that maybe didn't exist before. Like somebody came through, they had this, and they was like, well, where'd you guys come from? We're going to go get some more of this, and we're going to bring you some of what we have to do this, right? So
absolutely. Yeah. And it's patchy. But when I say patchy, mm-hmm. the distribution is patchy. So as an example, if you look at California and the kind of, you know, South Central California or Eastern California along mm-hmm. the edge of the Inyo Mono region, there's quite a lot of volcanoes and volcanic glass sources. But as you move in the far Southern Sierras and you go into the Central Valley and you go to the coast, there are none. So yep. they really had, at least in California, this east-west corridor of, they call it the Obsidian Highway.
Nice. Well, let's talk about one of the areas that you've worked in and what kind of brought on this conversation and what the obsidian picture looks like up there.
Well, I've been working in California for nigh on 50 years. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I'd never been to Oregon. Never even been to that place.
It's right California's over the border. A long state.
Yeah. So they hired me because they knew of my background. The woman from this particular department worked with me when I was at Caltrans, and they knew if they were able to con me into working there, they could have someone who could help them unravel the details of this major project. The major project, what fostered the largest project of my personal career, goes to about $9 million just in cultural activity, was the largest fire ever experienced just over the border along Highway 5, just north of the border between California and Oregon. Mm-hmm. And appropriately, it burned thousands and tens of thousands of trees on a mountain called Burnt Mountain.
Wow.
All right. Go. Yeah. And there's a lot of very picturesque landscape in Oregon. You see these tremendous forests, these great rivers, and the area was quite a storehouse for some tremendous resources, what they call the anadromous fishes, the big salmon runs that were there are exactly in the areas where we had this work we had to do, because the fire burnt all the trees down, right? And if you've ever worked in Oregon or someplace that is heavily forested, you can't really see the ground very well, can you?
No, you can't. Definitely
not at all. And so once we had the ground cleared up, it displayed tremendous amounts of artifacts. Mm-hmm. Even those that were isolates turned into sites, and even a small scatter turned into an enormous site. The largest site there was called Conglomerate, because there was a conglomerate there, and they had ruled it ineligible because when they excavated it, they found it was tremendously, you know, bioturbated. It had a lot of mixture in terms of the dating of the artifacts and moved around from, you know, from various factors, everything from cultural and natural factors that caused this stratigraphy to sort of lack integrity. But interestingly enough, you don't need that, because if you have volcanic glass artifacts and if you have temporally diagnostics and you get enough of them, you can reconstruct prehistory and the stratigraphy, even if it's all mixed up.
Right. So, now, before we get too far, some people might be wondering what the fire actually does to some of these artifacts. How does it change them? Does it wreck them? Does it destroy them? Why don't you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, no, the fire is a tremendous adversary to archaeological sites and to certainly to obsidian artifacts. I had read intellectually books and journal articles that told me that the fire would destroy the obsidian hydration rims and that they would not be able to be dated. And guess what? They were right. So all of those surface artifacts that are made of volcanic glass couldn't help us. We had to get subsurface artifacts that are not as heavily affected and then use those as a window into the prehistory of the area. And fortunately, there was subsurface artifacts and excavations done on one of the biggest sites that we had discovered in our entire work there. Additionally, it was a massive project. They had unbelievable numbers of archaeologists working there. They brought in a series of helicopters that had to pick up the trees that had fallen and to lay them out in decks. And they had people that would have to evaluate those trees and find out if they're falling now or they're going to fall in about 5 years. If they're going to fall, could they fall over the transmission line and start another fire? So anyways, that was a big deal. And there were literally tens of thousands of trees moved around to pick them up and try to clear out the area and make it safe. Safe to drive in and safe so there's no fires that would be created.
Right. All right. Well, so many questions around that big site you guys found and some other stuff around trees, but let's do that on the other side of the break. So we'll see you guys in just a minute. Welcome back to episode 158 of the Rock Art Podcast. We're talking about obsidian conveyance systems and what that actually means. But at the end of the last segment, you were talking about a couple of things that I want to come back to. First off, the trees in a fire. Well, we've been doing some house hunting, so to speak, over in North Carolina, and North Carolina had Hurricane Helene come through, what was it, two falls ago, basically, so a little over a year ago. And there are so many trees down. And one of the ways that you can actually find some artifacts sometimes in a forest like that is by looking at the tree falls and the massive amount of dirt and things the roots pull up when a tree falls over. And I would imagine that would have been a source for not excavation per se, but to see maybe some subsurface artifacts that maybe weren't affected by the fire as the trees collapse and fall, you know, as a result of that action or that fire.
Absolutely, because when trees fall, it brings up so much of the subsurface.
Yeah. And
there is subsurface material, so you can find sites that you would otherwise not be able to find.
Yeah, for sure. We use that all the time in the Southeast working over there because, like you said, you're doing survey and you can't hardly see the ground, especially if it's, say, fall. There's a lot of leafy trees out there and it just covers the ground. And we're doing survey and shovel testing intervals. But in between those, if you come across a tree fall, you definitely check it out because it's like free excavation. So, you know, it's a little bit out of context, but at least it's...
No, it's important. The ground is usually covered by needles and decomposing other materials because these are dense forests that have come to light. And although they've been harvested for lumber, and this is one of the premier lumber places in all of the Americas, I believe... That's what they talk about from their history, that if you're in Oregon, it's interesting. I worked in Oregon now for the last four or five years. And the other area that I worked in was the Cosos. So the Cosos has 3 inches of rain a year. How many inches of rain does Oregon have? 69 inches of rain annually.
Yeah.
a little bit different, Alan.
Yeah, and all of that falls on the western half of the state too. You know, the eastern half is much like the coast.
Yes, when you get over in the plateau or even the basin. So anyways, I got there and I was, you know, interested in what the collection looks like and what the sites are. There was 100 archaeological sites, 100 that existed in the footprint of this project. And the project was huge. It was right along a transmission line. And so the surface artifacts were collected, the ones that were temporally diagnostic. And so we had a nice inventory of hundreds and hundreds of projectile points and other artifacts to deal with these sites. And as I began to immerse myself in the literature, the nagging question I had was, all these sites are composed almost exclusively or dominantly of volcanic glass. Artifacts, shreds, chips, points. Where were they getting the volcanic glass? The nearest source is 100 miles away. I'm telling you, 100 miles away. And I said, "You in California, you wouldn't see that. You would see this down the line gradation is as you're getting further and further away from the obsidian source, you get less and less volcanic glass. And it gets smaller and smaller packages and smaller artifacts. And sure, you're going to see, you know, some fully complete obsidian points or other things. But the element, the value, the relative representation does follow this down the line gradient. And the literature, the anthropological literature, the theoretical literature, says that early on in prehistory, we had much larger catchments or areas that the Indians would have traveled, especially during Paleo-Indian times. And during that period, they purportedly would have had access to a larger array of distant obsidian sources. And so we would see within the archaeological record that early on there was a greater variety of sources at a greater distance. And as the native people became more settled, less mobile, and had either a semi-sedentary or sedentary village existence, that the number of sources of obsidian, both the variety, would be diminished. So mm-hmm. that's what we would say. Also, we believe that if you follow Binford and some other people that are, you know, experts on foragers, hunter-gatherers around the world, that their catchments, their mobility patterns are fairly lean. We're talking about, you know, that they would go, you know, 20, 30, maybe 40 miles outside of their home base, but nothing really much further. There was a catchment, and they would be localized, and they would find all the resources that they needed within that catchment. Does that make sense?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And that makes a lot of sense. Even people today generally don't often travel outside of
they bloom where they're planted.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. So I started asking the archaeologists that I met there, and you know, I didn't get any answers. I really didn't. They said, "Well, we've always had obsidian here, and it's part of the deal." And I don't know, it's just the nature of the beast. You know, that's how they would answer. And I go, "This is crazy. There's something else going on here that doesn't make any sense to me. It looks so different from California. Whatever's going on here is something different. Something maybe not unique, but certainly very different from what I'm used to." And so I said, "Well, where's the biface caches? What do they mean, biface caches? Where's the preforms? Where's the obsidian trade objects that would have been imported in here? Where do they occur, and when do they occur?" So, of course, the local museum had a cache, and it was found right there in our region. And they had, 20, 30 bifaces, all of obsidian, sitting there in this cache. You don't find that in California. You really don't see that much movement for that large an area moving that far. You just wouldn't have that. Well, then I found out there were several other caches that were set up that way as well, all along this general area. And they all had these nice, chunky, big fistful of preform biface quarry caches.
Yeah.
And then they were dated, and they were from two different obsidian sources that were over 100 miles away, and they were 4,000 years old.
Wow.
Both of them.
Yeah.
So that really rang my chimes, and I said, there's something really serious going on here that doesn't make a lot of sense.
Did that coincide, that date, with some of the diagnostic projectile points that were found and those typologies and where they fall?
Yeah, absolutely. This was the middle, the middle archaic, where there was, if you're in California, of course, this is the heyday, the golden age of California hunter-gatherers or hunter-gatherers in general, where there was, reasonably good weather, and we had a chance to sort of develop our socio-political organization to a point where we had a fairly elaborate interchange and luxury items, et cetera, all that and much more.
Yeah, it's really interesting because just the association, all that stuff. And first off, I like it when dates intersect. That's always good thing.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Where was the obsidian source 100 miles away? I'm just curious. Was it laterally?
It was, that no, that was all out towards the plateau and the Great Basin.
Ah, okay.
Straight line out there. It was called Saikan Marsh was one. Spodu Mountain was another. There was another one called Obsidian Buttes, another one. All that was out there in that area. There was one quarry for obsidian that was closer, like 40, 50 miles. They didn't use it. They didn't use it because they almost ignored it because the obsidian that was there was in little tiny little pebbles. And so they could be used for the smaller arrow points, but if you're trying to make a dart point, they'd be pretty useless.
Yeah.
So they avoided that for the most part. But what surprised me and what has been going on in the last 4 or 5 years, coincidentally, right, is the reimagination of the cultural evolution and the peopling of the Americas. Well, that's in the Pacific Northwest, where they're finding all of these sites that are pre-Clovis, right? Mm-hmm. That are 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18,000 years ago, way before Clovis. And those are all there in that general vicinity. So there's something also going on about the antiquity of these sites and about the nature of Paleo-Indian and immigrations, etc.
Well, Oregon, I mean, just to the west of there, but still in Oregon, Paisley Caves, some of the oldest, you know, cave dwelling sites that we have in North America are right there.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there's a, you know, there's a relative resurgence in a sort of a, what would you call it? It's a change in the model drastically in terms of re-engineering our understanding of prehistory and the peopling of the Americas. And guess what? This site, this particular expression falls within that because we have found a piece of obsidian from 17,000 years ago from a little bitty quarry just about 50 miles north of our project.
Wow. Okay. Nice. That's really cool. All right. Well, let's go ahead and take a break and we'll come back and sort of talk about what all this means back in a minute. Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 158. And we started this conversation talking about obsidian conveyance systems. And we've been talking about the site Alan worked on in Southern Oregon and the obsidian and what was located there, where it's from, how old it is, and things like that. So what are the big ideas here? What are we leading this all to? How does this lead into obsidian conveyance systems and what that all means?
What the surprise is for this particular sub-region, it's called the North Umpqua River Basin, is that in this area, it appears likely that either they were having a very preferential relationship in terms of trading and moving that volcanic glass and substantial quarry blanks into their villages, their temporary sites, what have you, all the way from, you know, word go for about the last 10, 11, 12,000 years. And that's an unusual system. That's not something that would have been anticipated. It also doesn't seem to follow in any way, shape, or form to the stuff to the south in California. And as well, when you go to the coast, it doesn't work either because they only have a few percentages of obsidian and virtually none. It's overwhelmed by non-obsidian materials such as cryptocrystalline church, what have you. So what we're looking at is an unusual system. So, you know, you scratch your head and try to explain it. Well, one of the things we've learned about what was going on in the Pacific Northwest, there was a huge emphasis on trade, exchange, and long distance interrelationships between groups. They had a trading language. It was called Chinookan. And it was not unusual, according to the native people who are part of this research, for the native people to travel 100 miles or more to connect with others for this social engagement and trading.
Yeah.
Now, these were people that had access to tremendous amounts of resources because of the anadromous fishing at those fishing localities that are some of the top fishing localities in the world because of the bounty of salmon and other anadromous fish that they could get, you know, get their hands on. They were right there.
Yeah. Wow. That's really interesting because, I mean, honestly, too, I got to say, one thing I was thinking about when you were saying that was this whole, you know, this source being 100 miles away, that whole thing. That sounds like a long ways, even for people who drive.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Half, right?
I mean, how far can you go walking? I can do about, I can do about 10 miles. What, more?
Sure. But look back then, right? It's not like they had to take off work to go, you know, do this whole thing, right? Like they, this was their job, survival.
So, yes, yes.
You know, taking care of your family and survival was your jobs.
Yeah.
Taking 3 or 4 days maybe to go 100 miles, because I'm sure they could cover a lot more than we could in a day.
Oh, they could, definitely.
You know,
definitely.
10 miles was what they did before breakfast, right? So,
right.
You know, they could cover this distance if they needed to. And I feel like they probably just did it all the time, you know, because yeah. that was life.
That was who they were. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's one of the things I really like talking about this for, because it helps shift your perspective and remove your modern bias, right? When you start thinking about this, like this was just living back then, and that's how they did it.
And they did it regularly, because one of the things we had going for us up there was we had the Mount Mazama ash. So this huge volcano that blew its top to the north of us produced a fine layer of lapilli or pumiceous, you know, volume, and it layered itself within these archaeological sites. So when there's excavations, we know that anything below this layer is before the explosion that blew the top off of the mountain. And so it's about 7,000 years ago, 6,900 years ago. And that is very helpful to us. But it appears that all this stuff that's occurring environmentally or geomorphologically, geologically, really had no big effect on them. They just kept doing the things that they were doing. They probably left for a while and came back. The other thing that was amazing to me, so I talked about those two, you know, the several sources that are about 100 miles away. What about the source that's 200 miles away? Well, yeah. Guess what? That one came in as well throughout prehistory, but in little tiny sherds, little tertiary flakes, and not in the big bifaces that we saw throughout prehistory from the 100 mile site, because it was to the south in California in the Klamath area.
Right.
And so the obsidian came regularly, but in much smaller amounts.
I wonder if I'm just thinking about the logistics of that, because if it's further away, it was probably traded much more closely, like maybe, yes, you know, people in between there.
Yes.
But obsidian is so easy to modify. Like you can make a shape and then you break it. You just make another shape, right? Like if you know how to work obsidian, you can just make it into something else. So by the time it got to where you were, it could have been just worked a number of times by different cultures.
Yeah.
And then by the time down it got to you, it was just smaller.
Yeah. Just a little bit of pitslick in you.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah, a little bit of nothing.
One thing to mention too, I know various podcasts probably in the APN mentioned Mount Mazama, especially ones that work in the West. And you might be thinking, how the heck am I supposed to know where that is? Well, you probably do know where it is. It's Crater Lake. Mount Mazama was a 12,000 foot tall mountain. I know a lot about this thing because I've worked in Washington, I've worked in Oregon, Nevada, anywhere near there. When this thing blew, it was, and I had to look this part up because I didn't remember. It was 40 times the power and intensity of Mount St. Helens, which was up near Seattle. In fact, I was alive. And we had ash covering our cars and lawns and things when I lived in Washington after Mount St. Helens blew. I think I was 5 years old. And but 40 times. So the entire mountain basically blew up and then collapsed in to what became Crater Lake. So it just completely destroyed itself. And all of that material was all over the Western United States. And that layer is a highly definable layer. And if you're above or below it, you know where you sit. So
yeah,
it's pretty cool.
I went out to a cave that David Hurst Thomas, who's the director of prehistory, the American Museum of Natural History, that was he was excavating in the Great Basin in the Desert West in Nevada. And there was a perfect layer, looked like China, just sitting there inside that cave showing 7,000 years ago. It was very impressive. And we had that same phenomenon to some degree there in the region I was working in, the North Umpqua River, because there it was, plain as day. But what's interesting is even below that level, the overwhelmingly dominant tool stone that they were using was volcanic glass.
Yeah.
In big pieces. And they were reducing it, you know, down. Part of the story there was that some of the groups that lived in this particular region never really didn't determine to live in permanent year-round villages until very late in time. Hmm. They were happy with seasonality. They were living off the land just fine. We don't need to be, you know, tied down and live in these permanent villages like you guys are set up. So they were this particular strategy for extracting resources from the landforms and the environment was fine by them. And so that probably contributed to this phenomenon where these people interacted. When archaeologists went in there, they said one of the major elements that hit them between the eyes was there's nowhere to live. There's very little flat ground. Everything yeah. is so overgrown and treacherous that it would seem that this would be an environmental factor that would lessen the ability to interact with other groups. But it seems to be exactly the opposite. Because of that difference, there was long distance interchanges and close associations between these groups, even though they were in this very cut up environment.
Interesting. Wow. Okay. Well, is the final report for this project in?
Well, it's only going to be a couple thousand pages. That's all. I've been working on this for 4 or 5 years now. And I say in the next month or two, it'll be done. The narrative itself, the forward material, is 1,000 pages. And the appendices are, I think, several thousand more. So there's just so much data here. And it's so, the problem is when you work in Oregon or work in the area that I worked in Oregon, it isn't like California and it's not like the Great Basin. There's such diversity in the artifacts, in the projectile points as to their style, that it becomes overwhelming. It's very different. There's a tremendous amount of differentiation and a tremendous amount of different cultural influences coming into that area.
Yeah. Well, and that does make a lot of sense too, because they lived relatively near to the coast. They were in a forested, almost rainforest environment in western Oregon. And then Eastern Oregon is basically a desert landscape. And then you've got Washington and California on the both ends of that are basically the same thing. And
so you got plateau, you got Great Basin, you got the coastal, you got all these different groups from all around you that are influencing or sending various messages or data sets into your interaction sphere. And it just, it's not simple. It's very complicated.
Yeah. And I was thinking about that too, is like, I've done a lot of work in Nevada's Great Basin, and you know, a lot of areas in the Great Basin are very similar to themselves ecologically, right?
Yes, so yes.
When you have groups, even a lot of different groups of people working there or living there, I should say, but they're all kind of hunting and eating the same types of things. So they probably have a lot of very similar tool sets and things like that. But when you have these very different zones that people are living in and a lot of people moving up and down the coast and doing different things, yeah, I can just imagine the diversity of invention really for the tools that they had would have been much higher. Yeah. Because of necessity.
Right. And these would be what you would call complex foragers. These are because they had such an abundant base of foodstuffs at their fingertips.
Right.
So it was a different gig.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Okay. Well, that was awesome. I love having conversations like this. We didn't talk about rock art, but sometimes there's a bigger picture.
I look for it. Yeah, exactly. There's a couple of rock shelters outside of the area of the project. And I read the reports on it, and they were areas that the native people went to as refugia and refuge when the Euro-Americans came in and were threatening them. They were dying tremendous amount of death from all the disease vectors that were coming in. So they moved out of the area where we were, and they tried to hide from the soldiers in these rock shelters. And those rock shelters have a similar pattern of depictions of Euro-Americans, but also similar kinds of imagery, which is akin to the ghost dance rock art that I've written about and presented on, trying to find supernatural ways to rid themselves of this invasion of Euro-Americans or come back to a steady state with what they were, where they were living before these exotic people came in and tried to rid themselves of them. Does that make sense? Yeah.
It does. Yeah. Interesting. All right. Well, I think with that, we'll leave it there. And we will, we've got our producer, Ash, has got a number of really good guests lined up for the next few episodes. So we're looking forward to that. But this was also really fun to do. So, all right.
See you in the flip flop, gang. Hope you enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.arcpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.arcpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.